pounds worth, reel 10.
And asked him if he could ride, and he said no. So I said, well, told him to get up, stop the last wagon, and told him to get up on the box seat, you see. And he asked me, could I ride? And so I said, yes, sir. And so they put this kit in this wagon, and I took his horse. And he walked alongside. I never forgot that.
Mm.
And we got to Flamantinge.
So when you were at Croustrat,
mm-hmm.
near Ypres, and preparing for the Passchendaele attack, did the artillery methods there vary from what they'd been earlier?
No, we were doing mostly counter-battery work and strapping roads for transport. That was the job of the 60 pounders as a rule. We used to observe from Hussar Farm, which was going the upper floor, you see. There was no ground. Put this way. The upper floor, the boards were all gone. We used to get up a staircase, which was hanging on by the wall, and walk around the edge where the floor was still, you know, to some extent attached to the wall, to get round to the window. In the middle, there was a heap of boards and brickwork and slates, you know, tiles and things, was from above, completely open up above. It was just a wreck. And we didn't learn until later there was a couple of dead mules underneath it until the horseflies started getting busy. But some artillerymen, I suppose, field artillerymen, used to bring their ammo up on a pair of horses, you see, a pair of mules, instead of having the limber, because if a limber was brought and one pair of horses got knocked out, then the whole thing was a shambles. Whereas if you had your horses separate, you used to lead them up and then ride them back. And this fella had gone off the road during the night for shelter and been hit. And that was it. Whether the man was there, I have no idea, but the horses certainly were. The stink was terrible.
Mm. Now, after a couple of weeks of general artillery work, the actual bombardment prior to Passchendaele, was that different from in any way from the earlier bombardments?
No, I don't think so. It was. Well, they put over a sufficient fire to try and keep him quiet, you see, while our fellows got over the top. But, of course, the you couldn't do much with these pillboxes, you see. At that time, Jerry got a lot of these pillboxes. They were round, like a hemispherical in shape, made of reinforced concrete, and shells just bounced off them very, very often. And then when our fellows went over me, these fellows, there were slits in these places, and the machine guns firing through there, so it was just, you'd got to actually get into the place and throw bombs in it before you could subdue them. You couldn't subdue them in any other way. You'd got to bomb your way out of it.
Mm.
That's why it was so costly.
Do you have any recollections of what the conditions were like at Passchendaele?
Yes. The attack started on July 31st, and they used the tanks. Well, at that situation, the natural drainage of this absolutely flat country had been destroyed. The ground was thoroughly waterlogged. Shell holes had water in them to within a foot of the surface, and the tanks just got hopelessly bogged down. We moved our guns up from the Croustrat through Ypres onto the Menin Road in front. I don't know where they were going to, but before they got there, they were turned back. And we came back to our original position and had to turn out some Australians to put our guns back in position and back in action again. But we did move up a few days later, and we took up a position on the right of Menin Gate in front of the ramparts, in front of the moat. And we were there from that date, July 31st, for the next few weeks. And the activity there was such that we never, I don't think, had six guns in action all at once. There was always one, if or more, down at Saint-Omer, having a new liner put in, because the nominal life of a 60-pound was supposed to be 3,000 rounds, and we were going up to 5,000 and over. But as we were firing 1,000 rounds a night, average, out of the four guns, you can imagine it wasn't long before a gun had fired its 3,000 or 4,000 rounds within about a fortnight. I mean, 3 weeks they wanted relining in. Yeah. So that we're always one or two guns short. And the observation post from that point was at Jasper Farm. So That was a jerry pillbox. There had been a farm there someday, no doubt, but all we had was a jerry pillbox, with the entrance, of course, facing the enemy. First time I saw it, I didn't like it one little bit. There was two or three dead jerrys in the trench, approach trench outside. As we found out later, there was another couple underwater inside it, and the stink was abominable. So we would have to go up to that place about every other night, manning it. And one night, we'd been there, we should have been relieved before dawn. Well, we'd be there all day, you see. We used to do a night and a day, and we should have been relieved after dark. This was the mob never turned up, and it got to daylight. We found out then that they arrived, and there'd been another one nearby, Yulan Farm, only about 200-300 yards away, but they thought that was the right place and then found out it wasn't. You'd only map coordinates to go by, and there was no landmarks left at all. So that meant that we'd got to get away, and it was no longer in darkness. You see. We crawled as best we could until we got to the road, and then it was a corduroy road. Well, of course, Jerry had it under observation. It took us about 3 hours to get back to the battery, because every time we moved, we had field guns on us, you see. And by then, we were thoroughly fed up, and had one man called Boiling, who was a Londoner. I don't know where he came from as a reinforcement, but he was a well-educated man. He played for Blackheath, rugby team, remember that. And when we got back to our battery, they were in action, and he just walked up to a gun which was ready to fire and pushed the man out the way, got out of the lanyard, gave it a jerk and fired the gun. And the number two on the gun looked at him a bit amazed. And Bubbles, as we called him, turned on and said, "I hope that hit some bugger in the back of the neck." So.
Sorry, I thought you'd finished.
Oh. Well, while we were there, we used to see these dogfights in the evening up above, you know, with the aeroplanes. Watched them evening after evening, used to watch them with binoculars. And there was one came down, fell behind us, in Ypres, you see. He was on fire, Jerry, and one wing dropped off, you see, and then the second wing dropped off, and he came down, this is like a torch, like that. And I always remember one of the chaps sat near me just said, "Well, poor bugger," just like that, you know, because it just landed, I should say, about 150 yards from us, over the ramparts, on the cobblestones in Ypres, mm-hmm. and it smashed clean through those cobblestones into the ground.
Now, I know in September 1917, you came under attack from enemy gas shells for the first time. What was that like?
Well, there's no great noise about it, because there's only sufficient explosive in the shell to open it up. The shell itself is filled with liquid gas. The nose is spigoted into the cylinder part and held on with either lead or rivets or wooden pegs. And in the bottom, there's a bursting charge which compresses it enough to shear those rivets and allow the gas to come out as a liquid, and it evaporates like that, you see. I just got back to the battery that night at about midnight, and that moment he started. Well, we're very, very short of men, and they were inexperienced men too, so I started doing the line mending myself. Not with any great hope, because I'd six lines out from the battery to adjacent batteries, to the observation post exchange in the ramparts behind, and to the brigade headquarters, but all those lines were broken within a few minutes, and I never once got any communication with anybody outside. And they kept that up until 7 o'clock in the morning.
Look, let's go back to this gas attack itself, because as far as you were concerned, it was the first gas attack, and therefore was a new experience for you. Could you describe it in a little more detail for me? I mean, how did it differ from normal
shell
attacks? Well,
there wasn't any great danger from splinters or explosives or anything like that. All that was happening around you, hearing these thuds and plops, you know, and the clouds of vapour rolling about, you see. You couldn't see that much in a gas mask, you know, and all I was doing was crawling about with the lines, but following them by feel as much as anything, you see.
Yeah. How much casualties did the gas attack cause?
Very, very heavy. Because a lot of the chaps in the dugouts were getting it worse than I was in the open, because the gas is heavy, you see, and sinks in the dugout, you see, and they're getting it worse than I was, I suppose. And also, I'd got a new box respirator, you see, that had been replaced, so that the life of the box was so many hours, you see, I don't remember how many, but they didn't last indefinitely, you see, and mine was a new one. So it got on your chest to some extent, but with a Jew boy there, who was the RAMC orderly attached to the battery, I never knew him by any other name but Ikey. He was sort of a loner as far as the battery was concerned. He'd mend your clothes or anything like that and not want any money for it, you know, very obliging chap. He'd cut your hair. And yes, I sometimes feel guilty about it. Nobody made a friend of him, really. And that chap was taking blinded men, you know, with this mustard gas, to a dressing station in Ypres, one lot after another. And he came back on from one occasion, and a shell had pitched in this, it was a cavalry barracks, I think, it pitched in the parade yard, and about 70 casualties more amongst the wounded men. But when he'd finished taking them all away, I don't think there was above 30 of us left out of about 100.
Did this gas attack more effectively limit your battery's operations than the conventional shell attacks had?
It stopped us. You see, we hadn't sufficient men to carry on.
Yeah.
And
why did it stop you, do you think? Was it due to the inadequacies of your equipment? What kind of equipment did you have to deal with gas? You mentioned a box respirator.
Oh, yes, but I mean, the point is that you'd so few men that you couldn't man the five guns we'd got. We'd only, as I say, less than 30 men left in officers and everybody. We did a bit of firing, I don't remember, but we were due to be pulled out, you see, straight away. But before we could be pulled out, he repeated the dose 5 days later, on the 10th.
It sounds as if the effectiveness of the gas was due to the surprise that it caused, that you hadn't been expecting it, and you weren't really equipped to combat it.
The only thing is that the gas will burn, you see, apart from the respirator only protected your lungs, it didn't protect your body if you got burns or anything, you see. I don't know what happened to all the men. I mean, I was so busy at the time, and they were just taking these fellas away. If a man wasn't fit for duty, they took him away, you see. That's all. A lot of them would recover, I've no doubt. But we were short-handed. Mm. And so on the 10th, they say, he repeated the dose, and then it would be a few days later, we were relieved by another battery. I've forgotten who it was now.
Did rats cause much of a problem for you?
They used to pinch your rations at night. They did gnaw through your anything you put them in, unless it was in a metal container, they'd get at it. But the gas attack shifted a lot of them, because after the attack had finished, when we saw in the morning, there was dozens and dozens of these rats crawling about on their bellies, and we were just stubbing your toe underneath them and landing them in the moat, in the water. But there were two swans which lived on the moat there, and they were up on the ramparts, apparently unharmed.
When the gas didn't do the job of getting rid of the rats for you, were there any particular methods you yourself used to adopt?
No, with nothing. No.
Yeah.
Never. And yet, the thing which amazes me in that area, we had two men in the battery, Staten and Levick, who were professional poachers, I think. They were down in the books as mine, but they're professional poachers. But I saw one of those bring a rabbit in from that area for the officer's mess, and got £5 for it. Where the hell he got a rabbit in that area, I just don't imagine.
Now, when you moved south for the Battle of Cambrai, did you move as a complete battery?
All except the guns. We left those in position for the battery which took over from us, you see.
Was this standard procedure?
No. And it was too dangerous to try and get them out and put others back in. It was just exposing you, both units, to unnecessary risks. Mm. You might as well just leave them where they were. Because after all, it was a standard gun.
Mm.
And we didn't have any particular affection for any particular gun, because ours was replaced about every month. The rate they wore them out, the piece, that is the actual barrel of the gun, weighs 4,200 weights. That was replaced.
Well, when you got to Cambrai, now for the battle there in which the tanks played such a major role, did you have to adapt your methods according to the tanks that you had to work with?
Not our batteries, but we were doing the usual thing, you know, counter battery work and that sort of thing.
Mm.
We went down to Villers-Forken first, and from There was a general, General Knapp, KNAPP. He came to inspect us, and he had a medical officer with us, and said that there's very few of the men were really fit for duty. So we were sent down to Cerisi on a rest for a fortnight. We NCOs were in charge of squads of Jerry prisoners doing repair and construction work on this camp, which we're enlarging, you see. And then one morning, one of the chaps came to me and says, pack up. I said, what for? I said, we're going back up the line. One of the men...